Meditation.
Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I just feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Okay, what does it mean to become a Buddhist? To be a Buddhist, legally, officially? What are the rules? What's involved? Do I have to put a deposit down? Well, what's this all about? This is the topic of today's talk by Acharya Eric Spiegel. This was at our weekly Dharma gathering a few weeks ago, and this was a few days before he was to give the refuge vow ceremony. The refuge vow is the official vow one takes to become a Buddhist. So he talks about it. What does it mean? What does it mean in general to be a Buddhist? What are you committing yourself to? So if you've been listening for a while, if you have been meditating perhaps and getting interested or curious about that whole side of things, this is a talk for you. And, you know, if you're just interested in a nice dinner party topic that you can bring up. Hey, here's what I learned about being a Buddhist. Stay tuned. Visit our website, nmy.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. In particular, I want to point your attention to our introductory meditation weekend, which is called Shambhala Training Weekend 1. As you know, we offer it several times a year, and it's coming up next, the weekend of May 4th. And it's being led by David Perrin, another regular contributor to the podcast. So check out the link on the homepage for more information and to register, or check out any of our other offerings coming up later this spring. And now, here's Acharya Eric Spiegel.
Tonight's talk is in a week and a half, the weekend after this coming one, I will be teaching a program here called Entering the Stream, which I do each year, a program in which we give the traditional Buddhist vows of refuge and bodhisattva vows. So these are the vows in which people make a commitment to being a Buddhist. And we're one of the few places in really anywhere. The Shambhala community does this throughout our community, but New York is one of the only places where we really do it every year. And many other Buddhist centers in and around the area, they just maybe a teacher will be visiting and it will just be sort of, it'll just happen at that moment. But this is something that we do every year and that I've been really, I consider it as kind of one of the more significant things I get to do, to actually enter people into something. So today I wanted to talk about refuge vow, which is the first step of actually saying, many times people are practicing or studying or thinking about the Buddha's teachings for a long time and kind of consider themselves to be sort of Buddhist or sort of affiliated with Buddhist, or they think of themselves as Buddhist, but that step of actually saying something in a clear way seems to be really important. And as an acharya, as a teacher in this lineage, one of the things that I get to do, which most people don't do that much, is I get to enter people into vows, actually. So refuge and bodhisattva vow, also within the Shambhala teachings, there's a vow called the Shambhala vow. And also I do a certain amount of weddings. Last year I did 3 weddings. That's more than I usually do. So I think a lot about vows because most people don't give vows, right? So so it's kind of a weird karmic thing that I've ended up doing this. And usually we don't really think of, we might make an oath, you know, and then break it 10 minutes later. And that could even be like a wedding vow in some cases. And so And so, or a business deal or whatever. So culturally, or in our modern world, despite all of the talk about virtue and right and wrong, I often feel that there's really that people, we don't really understand what values are and how to hold them. So I do consider taking a vow to be a significant thing, and that it's that you, like, usually you go kind of like you go through your day, week, month, and life, and you like have a million, you're attached to a million different things. You're attached to hamburgers or vegan burgers or soy drinks, or and you're, or to sports teams or to fashion or to money or to neighborhoods or style, and you attach to all these different things. And but it's kind of like we also cast things off very easily. And when you actually say, I say something really strong with real intention, it could be like, just excuse me for a moment, but it could be fuck you, you know, it could be like that, like throw something at someone, throw words or throw daggers at someone. That actually is a very strong statement. That's stronger than, oh, I love the burgers at that place, or I love that scent, or I love that tie. That's a, that, so, so in a certain sense, a vow or a really clear commitment to something plants something in your mind stream. Deeper than the kind of discursive chatter that we usually have. And so therefore that vow should be done with clarity and intention, because you don't want to take the wrong vow. And so I think about the wrong vow also, you know. I think about like vows to Al-Qaeda, or, you know, vows where you actually end up harming people, where you sort of say, okay, you commit yourself to something that actually is going to deplete your life force. In a Buddhist understanding, for lifetimes, but we could just think about it, okay, just for this lifetime. So the refuge vow is the vow that one takes when one actually thinks, okay, this, these Buddhist teachings, these teachings of meditation, of are teachings of sanity, and they hold water, and they are trustworthy. And I would like to further bind myself beyond the next program or coming to the Dharma gathering for 3 weeks in a row or something like that, but actually plant something. The Buddha lived approximately 2,500 years ago, about 5th, 6th century BC. Primarily lived and taught and wandered in eastern India. He taught for over 40 years from the time of his awakenment. Everywhere he went, people... the way I can envision it is that people would just see him and their jaws would drop. They would just recognize that there was something completely extraordinary, because he wasn't preoccupied with himself. Therefore, he had tremendous radiance. In Shambhala, we say authentic presence, which is like that you... you're not like inward focused, it's just completely available. And so when people would see him, they would naturally stand. And they would say, How can I follow you? How can I follow your way? And he taught basic, simple instructions. He taught meditation. He said, first you have to notice that you have a lot of thoughts and that there's actually a difference between your mind and your thoughts, or your being and what you think about yourself. So, and then he said, and it's really difficult to do this in your life, so you need to kind of step away from your life. So we're in a really different time now, and particularly Shambhala. Trungpa Rinpoche was born in Tibet, by the age of five, he was the governor of a very large province, and he was the head of a 5,000 series of monasteries. And by the age of 18, he was leading a band of several hundred disciples by foot across the Himalayan mountains, avoiding roads to avoid the Chinese armies. And then he was a refugee in India. And then someone recognized him and said, you know, we should make something happen for you. And he was given a fellowship at Oxford, and he was able to study Western philosophy and psychology. He's still early 20s. And then he first established with some other Tibetan teachers sort of a monastery in Scotland. And then he realized that this is like a new time, a completely new time. And reestablishing Tibet in the new world wasn't what he was interested in. He was interested in actually meeting the people of the world and communicating their own wisdom, helping them to discover their own, that they actually could be the Buddha. That it's not just for Tibetans or Indians. It's like everybody, white, black, brown, yellow. Every walk of life. The first time I met him, I was a 19-year-old, and I very extremely shy, and I had the worst thing I had to tell him, and I don't even think at that time we had the word gay, but so I probably said something like I'm homosexual, and he said, I don't see any problem. So the point is that, like, no matter how screwed up you think you are, that it's actually workable. And that's the point of the Buddhist teachings, is that you are the working basis, not something outside of you, but you are the working basis. So I went through that little side trip there just to say, the Buddha really, when he taught, it was a different time. He asked people to leave their world, to separate from their family and their lives, and in India, to renounce their caste, so Brahmins would give up their robes and outcasts would give up their rags, and everybody would gather discarded fabric and sew their own robes. If you had lice in your hair, or if you had the most beautiful hair, you shaved your head. So men and women, young and old, from high caste or the lowest, walking down the road would be essentially indistinguishable, equal, which is radical. Of course, over hundreds of years, the patriarchy took over, but and we'll do that again. But but Buddhism was radical then, and I think it's radical now, that to say that I am not my thoughts and that I can. And then what Trungpa Rinpoche said is, okay, well, this isn't the time. People, it's no longer the time for people to retreat to monasteries and caves. Very few people could afford to do that. And really, it's running away from reality in a lot of ways. And what we, so Shambhala is based on society, is based on how can we actually awaken together, awaken in our world, rather than... And you do have to do inner work. That's the meditation practice. You do have to explore, but you also have to apply. So when the Buddha started teaching, students would gather around. Everywhere he went, people would gather around, and they would say, how can we bind ourselves to you and to your teachings? And he would say, the way to do that is to take the threefold refuge. So this is what the refuge vow that we give is. It's called the refuge in the three jewels. The first jewel is that we take refuge, meaning, refuge in this case, meaning like that you go for cover, like for shade or for protection, in the shade of, the cool shade of the Buddha. So the Buddha, not as a god, but as an example that an ordinary human being can tame their confusion and open their hearts and become awakened. And awakened isn't one thing. Awakened is continual. It's a continual journey. There's no like a light bulb. It's not a cartoon. Awakened. And then the second jewel that we take refuge in is called the Dharma, which are, the Dharma means the way, or it really means the law, and it refers to the teachings of the Buddha and all of the teachings that have stemmed from the Buddha through all these many centuries. So in every country of Asia, and then more recently in all the other continents of the world, the teachings have been taught in different languages to people having different experiences, in their own words, in a way that's relevant to them. So there's the historical teachings, which are called the sutras, and then there's the expression of that, which is what we are doing here. Just me talking to you in language you can understand about experiences that you've had of your own mind and your own world. And so the Dharma includes all of that. So the Dharma could include the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, it could include the teachings of Dogen Zenji, it could be, it include the teachings of great masters of India, Japan, Korea, China, Vietnam, Laos, and also of many great more modern Western teachers, Pema Chodron, and there are many great, wonderful Zen teachers teaching today. So all of that is the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, which constitute the way that we can start to parse our experience and mix it with the experience of our wisdom. And the last refuge, or the last jewel, is called the Sangha, and the Sangha is the community. So this would be the Sangha. Sangha is Sanskrit. All of these three words are Sanskrit, but in the best way to explain it really is to go to the Tibetan, which is Gendun. And Ge means virtue, and Dun, D-U-N, means aspiration. So the Genden are those who aspire to virtue, to develop, to live a meaningful life, to live a life of that is of benefit and does not cause further harm and confusion, but actually is of benefit to beings and causes wisdom to expand. So when we take refuge, we take these three. The actual vow is extraordinarily simple. It goes like this. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. You say that, you repeat after, I would be the preceptor, you would repeat that three times. First, you actually do three prostrations, which are the sense of surrendering, acknowledging that you're letting go of your ego, of your own your own ideas about reality. You're willing to challenge them or let them be challenged. And then you recite those words. But it's much more than those words. It's actually like when you actually do it, you've prepared properly. You've come, you've studied, and you have an intention. And there are witnesses, the Sangha, and often people invite their friends or family, come and they witness it. And so there's a sense of, oh, okay, not just casual, not just like another cheeseburger. So that'll be gone in 10 minutes. So it's a matter of like planting something and planting it so that it has a good chance of really taking root in your mind stream and in your being and propagating richness and sense of fullness. So I'm kind of just telling all of this so that people, if anyone here thinks about it, they could have some better idea, and then you could talk to the front office. But so there's a further vow. So I said there are two vows that are given. So generally people take refuge vow, and then at least 6 months, usually a year or more later, they would take the second vow. The refuge vow is in the West, in our world, refuge vow is, people consider it a really big step because it's like you were raised with whatever, as Joy said. I was raised with fundamentalist atheism pounded into my heart. So nothing exists. And or you were raised with, you know, Judaism or Christianity or Islam or Hindu or so. And in Tibet, even though it's a Buddhist culture, when people reach a certain point, they actually have to decide to take refuge, and they have to make that request and make that step. And so even though they're living in a Buddhist culture, they still have to take refuge. But it's considered really like not a very big deal because everyone takes refuge. But here, it's a shift. It's like saying, okay, I've discovered something, and I'm going to get in this boat and see where it goes. So it's a shift. But in Tibet, the Bodhisattva vow is what's considered a really strong vow, and people really, you would really think deeply before making that commitment, because the Bodhisattva vow is said to be a vow that lasts for all lifetimes until you attain enlightenment. So if you never attain enlightenment, you're still bound by that vow lifetime after lifetime. So it's called a heavy vow. So, but in the West, often people have already made the big step of becoming a Buddhist, so then the Bodhisattva vow appears on the horizon and seems like the natural next step. So it's kind of a funny cultural difference for us. But so I could talk a lot, but I would like to see if there are any questions or discussions. And then also there were quite a number of people here who were here for the first time. I don't know if it's the first time all of you have meditated, but I could take some questions about meditation practice too.
So when you're talking about taking a vow and it being a big step, something that I'm sort of think about when I think about Buddhism is how it's great that it doesn't mean renouncing something else, or do you feel that it does, I guess?
I think that it doesn't mean, like, okay, so I'm still very much from an atheist Jewish tradition. There's right. Nothing about me that is not Jewish or atheist in some way. That is not, I am very much my father's son. At the same time, I have a tremendous sense of, I would say, spirituality that has arisen over these decades. If you were had a more strong religious affiliation, and if you actually believe that God exists as an external deity, and that at the time of your death you will be judged and go either to heaven or hell, then probably Buddhism... The other vow that we give within the Shambhala training program is called the Shambhala vow, which does not actually require any kind of change of religion. But when you take refuge, you're becoming a Buddhist. So it doesn't mean you can't go to church with your parents or grandmother or whatever, and that you can't, and you can certainly still have a lot of love and respect for the traditions you've grown with. But what you believe, there has to be a little bit more space between the teachings and what you actually believe. Is that, do you understand?
Yeah. I mean, I personally feel like it's like an add-on. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like that's just, mm-hmm. that's me. And I guess it's mm-hmm. sort of figuring out how to bring those practices together. Because I guess the big question is, you know, how do they intermingle and do they conflict?
Yeah.
And I would like to say no, because I think more is more. But
I ask people to do when they sign up for a refuge vow is I ask people to meet with a meditation instructor, have an individual conversation, and then the meditation instructor can help you figure out if you're making a commitment that you don't want to be making, or if it's perfect, if it feels right. Okay? So, and the front office can help you connect with someone to do that. So that's kind of the, like, everyone who comes to take a vow has like a little check mark from a meditation instructor, and that way once we get to the program, I feel confident that people have had some conversation about it and it's been kind of just reviewed properly. I have a cousin who also was from my same background, but yet she's actually kind of adopted a pretty formal Jewish practice and at the same time a really deep Buddhist practice. And she's taken refuge in Bodhisattva vows and observes all the Jewish holidays. So, and says all the prayers. So I think it's individual, you know. I think it's kind of like, well, if you feel that you're not disrespecting anything, then it's probably workable.
I just Do you want to, can you share any more about the second heavy vow? I mean, you sort of talked about it a bit, but like, is it lengthier?
It is lengthier.
It's more lifestyle changing?
Well, no. But what it is, so the first vow is committing yourself to this path and these teachings. And at the time of the second, and as you do that, you start to experience, you start to do, so just when we were doing meditation, you know, there's like, oh, there's all our thoughts, which we usually kind of believe, and then we're letting them go and coming back here. So then gradually you start to see, oh, I have a lot of thoughts and they're constantly changing and they're not actually as real as I thought. And so then gradually as we practice, we start to have the discovery of the emptiness of both ourselves, like that we're not the fixed being we think we are, like, and also that the world around us is actually much less solid. And so, and that gives rise to, then we start to see, I am giving you like a lot of teachings in a few words, so just, you'll need more background here. But we start to see that there's so much suffering because people don't see things as they are. They see things and they think they're true, rather than that they are actually completely malleable. Like what you believe today, what you think about yourself, how you look today, completely different in 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. And yet we invest so much in what we believe and what we perceive, and that investment causes so much suffering. So people always trying to, people are always creating walls and moats and armor to protect things that actually don't exist. So this enormous wellspring of compassion is opened up. And that's the motivation for becoming a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva means awakened being. So there are two ways, you know, there are iconic bodhisattvas who are like the great saints of the Buddhist teachings, but I would say like in our reference points, Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln or and they could manifest in different ways. So that would be like, so compassion, like Mother Teresa or Florence Nightingale, people who just like go into the most difficult situations and just share their heart and kindness, or people who are able to unravel the complexities of reality and actually open up entire new horizons for the world, like Louis Pasteur or Marie Curie or Charles Darwin. Or then this other thing, which is like people who actually like have so much strength that they shift the paradigm of the cultures, such as Martin Luther King Jr. or Abraham Lincoln or Mahatma Gandhi or Rosa Parks. So there's a sense that these great bodhisattvas were really something. But then also, when we take the bodhisattva vow, it just means that this is the path. Now I know where I'm going. Before I had a general sense of like, I'm just trying to get saner. I see that this is a sane path and I want some clarity and some simplicity and some sanity. But now I realize, oh, there's a lot of suffering and I'm committed to engaging with it and bringing work, trying to meld my path of sanity with the culture of confusion that exists. So that's why it's a heavier vow, because it's, you don't get, just get to work with your own confusion, your own petty mind and distractions, but you actually have to like get your hands dirty. And usually when you get your hands dirty, they're dirty. Like, it's not simple. Nothing's simple. You don't get to do, you don't, you do something that you think is really going to be of benefit, and often people don't say thank you. So then you have to do it again.
I did get some Pema Chodron books here, mm-hmm. and one was like the Daily Pema. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name.
Yeah,
right.
Pema.
And then the other one, it talked about two big broad topics that struck me. One is she talks about the three commitments. I've only gotten to two of them. Do no harm, take care of one another is the second one. And then she talks about the eight worldly concerns, pain and pleasure, gain and loss, fame and disgrace,
yes.
praise and blame.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, I guess, I mean, it wasn't exactly what you were talking about, but I think those concepts you're probably very familiar with.
Yes.
So,
what would you like me to say?
Well, I'd like to know more about them.
Well, the three things you said, I'm not really familiar with that particular grouping, but they're all things that sound very, you know, part of the path, you know. The eight world, I mean, so when you're working, the eight worldly concerns are just like things, so that's just like one way of working with your experience, is to realize like how often we're expecting praise or we're giving blame, or where pride and poverty, or I can't remember what all of them are, but you know, it's like those are the places our mind goes. And so the thing is, with whatever occurs, to see it, like to see your mind and then let it dissolve and just be present. Let your whole attitude or your whole fixation, the whole storyline, see it. The moment you see it, to some degree, it already has dissolved. It may immediately come back again and reassert, because our karmic patterns are very deep. You don't just get to see something once. You have to see it over and over again until you're completely nauseated with yourself. So that's what they say. I didn't make that up. So it's just another way of working with our experience, of understanding the world that we actually have always lived in but never really noticed.
Thank you.
I have hesitated about taking vows of any kind, because it seems like in this case, once you become a Buddhist, then there are non-Buddhists. And so it almost sort of puts up a barrier between you and other people. And especially in our culture, since Buddhism is not sort of the norm, or at least in the community I spend most of my time in. So I'm curious about other people who have chosen the Buddhist vow, like... how does that show up in life? Like, how does that show up? That
so when we do the vow, there's actually being a Buddhist is actually supposed to have a significant difference in your life. It's supposed to make you more gentle, make you more aware. So there are traditionally there are. Like, what do you said, you kind of said you don't have to renounce anything. What you have to renounce is you try to renounce causing harm. And that has five specific categories. Taking life. Right? So it's actually almost impossible not to take life. But we do it so without thought, killing mosquitoes or ants or flies. So I live in the country. I live in an old house in the country. I catch flies and I put them outside. I try to keep mice outside my house so I don't have to deal with them inside my house. So not taking things that aren't yours. So not just seeing something and picking it up. So not borrowing things and forgetting to return them. Which is really a matter of like sort of working with your own poverty mentality that, oh, I see that and I should really have that, and they would see it that way too. And so, or like no one's going to notice, so I could just take it. No, you actually live a life according to some dignity where, okay, this is mine and that isn't mine. So if I want that, then I would ask for it and see what happens. Or not telling lies. So that really means not being a deceptive person. Like trying to actually be, look at people and talk directly, say what you mean, and be honest, be true to people about your feelings and what you see. So the fourth one is not causing sexual harm. So traditionally it would be abstaining from sex. The way I usually teach it is not abusing our charisma in whatever way, not manipulating people. And the fifth one, the last one, is abstaining from intoxicants. So the first four are things you really shouldn't do: killing, stealing, lying, and abusing your charisma. And the fifth one is you don't do it, because if you do that, then you'll do the other four. If you get drunk, then you'll do all those other things. So, and Trungpa Rinpoche was known for not abstaining from intoxicants. That was like his hallmark, was not abstaining from intoxicants. And so his community did not abstain from intoxicants, but it was really, really clear that you had to take full responsibility for your actions. You couldn't, there was never the excuse that you could say, oh, I was drunk. So that's, so in our community, it's more, you know, so the basic principle of all of those is like becoming aware of your footprint. So your friends might notice that, but and it might irritate them because there might be some stupid ass things that you've always done together that you no longer will do. You just say, no, I don't. And maybe at first you just kind of make excuses, and then at some point you just say, actually, I'm really just not comfortable doing that anymore. Slandering, you know, sitting around and telling stories about our friends who aren't in the room, you know. So sometimes it causes a shift. I mean, anyone who goes on a journey, you know, at some point the boat pulls out of the harbor a little, you know, and most of my lovers, ex-lovers, are not Buddhist. But there's a separation, you know, there is a separation. I won't say, especially, you know, I'm kind of some hoity-toity teacher, so. So I think it's a matter of, like, what is your conviction? I don't think it's really about that you're creating an artificial boundary. I think it's like, do you want to pursue this? And if you want to pursue it, then changes are going to happen. Not because you say I'm a Buddhist now, or you don't say I'm a Buddhist now.
I think the reason we mistrust boundaries is it depends really what we do with them, right? Boundary is not, okay, it's a label, fine. I've taken vows and the person next to me hasn't taken vows. Mm-hmm. That could be just factual, right? But after that it was, oh, do I treat her differently? Do I think of her, think of myself as being better? I don't think that boundary is by definition something good. We call it a boundary once we discover it shuts us off from the world. But I think Buddhism is about actually opening up to the world. So,
thank you. Where are you from?
I'm from Greece originally, but I've been in this country for 30 years or so, so you know, my accent is still...
Thank you. Thank you. All right, so I want to thank everybody. I'm so happy that people actually in the middle of New York and all of the life that all of us lead, that people take a time and actually do something on a Tuesday night and kind of try to explore meaningfulness and expand their mind and their heart. So I really appreciate everybody being here and your practice and your ears and eyes for this evening. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Acharya. Thank you all for listening. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. You can always email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org, your questions, comments, suggestions. But you're also always invited to come see us in person. Our weekly Dharma gathering is every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person, meet the other people, and get to know your local meditation center. If you live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Thanks for listening. Later.